and welcome. Thankful that you could make it on as in this format, if not in person. Are you there?
Well, I had a little trouble hearing it. What did you say, Ken?
Well, we want to welcome you, and we're glad you could make it on this format, if not in person. So we're going to do a sound check. What we'd like to do is go around the table. We're sort of in a big U, and let me know if you can hear particularly the first names of the people farthest from the phone. Okay?
Okay. Sounds good.
Carl Crimmins from Champlin.
Did you hear that?
Yep.
Okay, great.
Nancy Black, Minneapolis.
Marilyn Cathcart, Minneapolis.
Sonia Honadel, Moorhead.
Donnie Bailey, Rochester.
Zainab Hassan, New Brighton.
Earl Rasmussen from Blaine.
Kent Eklund from St. Paul.
Nimco Ahmed from Minneapolis.
Carolyn Williams, St. Cloud.
Dave Larkin, Bemidji.
Yvonne Condell, Moorhead.
Tim Hipsch, Maple Grove.
Janet Lexon, Lakeville.
John Dorn, Mankato.
How did that work?
That sounds great.
Okay.
I do want to say I apologize for having to do this on the phone. I had a long planned vacation and couldn't get out of that.
Well, we had there are family responsibilities, we understand, and we had a interview yesterday with one candidate from Dunedin, Florida. So I guess we're all curious to say, where are you?
I'm in Phoenix. I'm at Squaw Peak. It's a little resort on the edge of the mountainside in Phoenix.
Great. Great. Well, the format is we ask you to make an opening statement of highlighting some of your interest in being considered as a candidate. Then I'll ask the first question, and the rest of the colleagues here on the council will ask questions. And in about 40 minutes, we'll take you to the last question and the summary comment. You might want to make it in closing. Is that okay?
Sounds good.
So,
well, thanks. Oh, should I go ahead?
Yes. Sorry. Yes, go ahead.
Well, thanks for your flexibility to do this on the phone. I do appreciate that. I'm using my cell phone, so for any reason you can't hear me, just let me know. I could also call on the landline. But want to thank you for your flexibility, and thanks for talking with me today about the transition. I'm very excited about the opportunity and just wanted to briefly give you a little bit of information about my background and my experience and not take too much time because my guess is you probably want to focus more on questions. My first, one thing I thought I should mention is I went to Moorhead State University, or Minnesota State University, Moorhead. At the time, it was called Moorhead State University. And I was very active there. I was in Student Senate and a variety of committees. I was also in the Student Activities Budget Committee, was an RA, was also involved in other student organizations, and also was involved with the Minnesota State University Student Association, just even the fact that I was a student senator and then eventually became treasurer of the Student Senate. So, I was a very involved student, so just from the inner workings of a university, just to understand how that all works in various departments and stakeholders and all of that, I kind of got a pretty foundational experience right from the beginning as a student. And then I think that experience as a student, helped me in terms of understanding as a customer, as a student, which I would consider a customer and a stakeholder, and as a product. The product that we're selling is the educational degree. So that was a great experience. I really enjoyed going to Moorhead State University. And then I graduated from the University of Wisconsin, Law School in Madison, another public institution. And then I do have other boards and other governing experience. I served on the Minnetonka Planning Commission, which is, I think definitely some similarities, I would think, to the trustee board because it's a public arena. Anyone can come. And it can be, controversial at times. It can be difficult decisions when you're deciding whether people get a variance or whether or not they get the approval to go forward and build a home or proceed with their development. So, and then there's other nonprofits that I've been a part of in terms of the governing board, on the governing board, and just other volunteer boards. And then at Wells Fargo, my most recent position, for almost 4 years. I'm a benefits manager, and I manage both the non-health plans, which incidentally includes the tuition reimbursement program, and then also do compliance and administration issues for all of our group benefits, which includes the non-health plans and the health plans, the medical, life insurance, and all that kind of stuff. And in that role, I manage a high-performing team. I've got eight folks that are on my team, and we deal with complex issues. We deal with tough issues. One of the primary functions of my area is dealing with policy interpretations and communications and escalation, compliance, also includes vendor management, contract, finance, and legal and audit, the whole wide variety of issues that I think, you know, definitely a solid foundation for a position like this, because just due to the complexity of the issues and all, also due to the various stakeholders, you know, the state Minsky system is complex. It has a lot of stakeholders, whether it's the business leaders who are asking us to provide certain educational opportunities to our students, and also legislature. So at a large, complex organization like Wells Fargo, there's a lot of similarity in terms of dealing with a variety of stakeholders and all of that. So that's just general background, and I hope that it gave you kind of a flavor of my experience, and look forward to your question.
Thank you, John. First question relates to a very important activity that will take place in the first year of this next group of trustees, and all of the veteran trustees as well, and that is our chancellor will retire June 30 of 2011. So during the first year, you'll be involved in a leadership succession and leadership transition. What we'd like to ask is any experiences you've had as a board member or in management on leadership succession, and some principles you've identified as important for successful transitions.
Well, I mean, I think a pretty unique experience to select someone like that. So I will admit I don't have experience in terms of selecting a leader of that level. I would say, you know, as a manager, I do have been involved in selecting and reviewing criteria for dozens, probably hundreds of candidates for various jobs that have been filled on my team and others as well. So just that basic experience of a manager in terms of selecting people, you know, I do have that. I think, you know, and there have been other various organizations where we have selected leaders, just not obviously, you know, at that level. I think for me, a transition would be a successful transition is both one that minimizes unnecessary disruption. So, you know, to have sort of the B players, the vice chancellors in place to fill the role as needed. You know, if there were a gap in terms of leadership, although I'm speculating that there probably wouldn't be, because you'd want to bring in the other person and time that appropriately. But avoiding unnecessary disruption. And the other thing I think when you bring in a new leader, it's also an opportunity. Bring somebody else who has a different set of experience, a different perspective, and the institution is evolving and changing over time as it needs to. And so I think it's also a great opportunity to see, you know, what does the next leader bring it to the next level? What additional experience can they add? And it's kind of like the lifeline or the life of a business goes through various leaders, ones that start things up and then ones that that changes and bring new experience. So I view it as an opportunity. And I think what I would be looking for in terms of a new leader would be obviously somebody who has exceptional qualifications and also somebody who's a great listener and has great strategic thought in terms of being able to see the forest, but also being able to have that ability to look down at the trees into the details. So one thing that I really value in a leader is somebody that can both look at the bigger issues in the strategy, but also is capable of looking into the details.
Great. Thank you. Other questions now from the council? Carl?
I'd like to know, what strengths would you bring to the Board of Trustees?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one strength is dealing with complex issues and dealing with tough issues. Being a good listener. I think, you know, a lot of times people want to talk, but it's often important to listen and really understand issues and understand challenges. And so I think being a good listener and also asking good in-depth questions. I think that's one of the strengths that I have, is to ask the questions to get to the heart of the issue.
Okay. John? Do you have more? I'm sorry. John Dorn. Sorry.
I didn't know if you had more to say, but this is another John, and thank you for applying. Asking you to follow up a little bit, you mentioned that it's an opportunity to put in place a new chancellor and one who would look at, you know, a system that is evolving and changing and has, you know, needs. Can you give me some idea of a few details of where you think the evolving and the changing, what that might look like, or what you have in mind when you say that, or what some of the needs are that you see that the board would be using as a benchmark to evaluate the chancellor's ability to take advantage of this opportunity?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very good question. Probably have to really give it some thought to come up with something. Would sound really smart, just when, you know, going into, you know, how you would selection criteria and all of that. But I do think that it would be great to ask some potential candidates what their view is of changes in technology and online education. I know that that's an important part of the MinSCU system. And in the future, I think there appears to be a demand from employers and students to have the ability to do more online education. Of course, that's, you know, balancing out from what should be done in person as well. But so I think that would be one key thing. And then I think one thing I would really want to know from a potential chancellor candidate is, what is their perspective, ability, insight, experience working with the business community to partner and find out what their needs are, and how do you take what they say they need in terms of training programs or subject areas they need to develop, and how do you take that and implement it, and have they ever successfully done that, you know, in a more significant way? Have they worked with business community leaders and said, hey, we have a need for... Maybe we need more welders, so can you offer a welder training or something, you know, maybe more complex than that? So I think that would be some of the areas I would want to ask them about.
Thank you.
Yep.
Nancy?
Yes. Can you please tell us what you feel are the most important contributions, maybe two or three, of the MinSCU system to the state over the last few years?
I think one of the key things is to help Minnesota have a vibrant economy, and in order to have that, the business community, and, you know, they need folks that are trained in the appropriate areas where the demands are. So I think the MinSCU system has an incredible opportunity to add to the economy, especially compared to maybe some private institutions that maybe focus more on advanced degrees or the U of M. It seems like that MinSCU really focuses on the ground up at sort of the grassroots level to really provide the training to sync up with what the business needs are. So I think, obviously, providing, you know, that opportunity for businesses to get people that are meeting their needs, it would be a key thing. I also think a second thing that the university has returned to the state or has benefited to the state is providing an opportunity for all kinds of people from all walks of life to go to college, to advance their life, to advance their career, to gain knowledge. So I think think there's an economic benefit, but there's also the benefit to all kinds of young people and older folks and anyone who wants to go and get some advancement in their education and open their mind and have some learning experiences. So I think those would be the two things that the state, that the Minsky system adds to the state.
Sonia?
John, with the ever-changing demographics in our state and the need that we see to replenish our workforce, how do you see the Minsky Board of Trustees helping to reach out to underserved represented populations and students to help with that effort, and what are your feelings about that?
I think recruitment is key to that question, which is a very good question. Whether it's recruitment of students or staff, and staff could be administrative staff, could also be, you know, educational staff. So recruitment is key. You have to create that bond, that connection, that relationship with communities of folks who may not have traditionally went and received a college degree as much as other folks of other backgrounds. So I think recruitment is key. I also think that having a welcoming atmosphere when people come to the institution, to the colleges and the trade schools, that when they're there visiting and as students, that they feel that they're welcome, that they're wanted, that they're invited. So I think both, you know, from the recruitment aspect and then also the experience that people have. I also think that we should, you know, also consider diversity broadly, to look at first generation and economically disadvantaged students from a variety of backgrounds.
Annette?
Yes, what do you think are the three top challenges facing the Minsky system, and how could be overcome?
Very good question. I think cost is an issue in terms of tuition and how that affects the accessibility of the institutions to a variety of people who may not come from, you know, higher income backgrounds. Quality, I think, you know, there's, with anything, when you have a limited amount of resources, you also have to prioritize and consider where you're spending your money so you get the best thing for your buck and you have the highest quality. So I think cost and quality, I think, would be the two things. And then I think probably third would be just how can an institution of that size be nimble enough, be adaptable enough to change over time, to be receptive to the changes that are out there in the business and student environment in terms of what they're looking for. In terms of how to overcome those are pretty big hills to climb, so I don't necessarily have all the easy answers, but I think in terms of cost and also the quality, it's just sound management, having smart people making good decisions, reviewing things, you know, keeping track of things in terms of a lot of data, so you see what's going on, and also listening to the students, I think, is key, and listening to other stakeholders. I think so, by doing some of those things, you can help mitigate and help advance some of the other goals that you have. I hope that answered your question, and if it didn't, feel free to jump in.
Thank you. Yeah, indeed you did.
She stole my question.
Oh, okay. All right. Other questions? Nancy.
Yes. You have mentioned cost of tuition, and we are in a period of severe financial crisis in terms of the cost of education. If you had been sitting on the board and had to vote on the bonuses given the pay for performance for the chancellor, the senior administration, and individual presidents of universities and colleges, in terms of the perception of the public, with 30 programs cut from St. Cloud and 80 faculty laid off from Mankato, what would you have done? What are your feelings on this?
That's a very, very insightful question, and I think that's one of those difficult situations where there really aren't necessarily easier answers, especially from a perception perspective. What I would say is there are all kinds of organizations that struggle, whether they're in the nonprofit or private sector, especially in the last couple of years. As you noted, it's been a tough economic environment, and that, of course, is affecting students that are trying to pay for school as well. But it is very important to have key leaders who have the knowledge, the experience, and the insight to run an institution of that complexity. So I think it depends on how the bonus plan is designed. But if it's designed and administered in a way that's consistent with performance, then I would support that. I think it's a little too easy just to say, no, I'm not going to support it because it looks bad. And, you know, sometimes difficult decisions have to be made that may not necessarily look the absolute best. You can try to explain it and communicate it. But, there is an economic environment out there, too, and those senior leaders can go to other places and make a lot more money, potentially. So I think you have to balance, communicating it effectively. You have to actually look into the details of the bonus plan to make sure that they're paying for performance. I mean, you wouldn't want them to be paying just to be paying because they're at a senior level. They have to actually be performing at a high level in order to get the bonus. Of course, look at, how much is the bonus in terms of percentage of comp to make sure it's not too exorbitant. And it is a tough perception issue, especially that, it is a public institution. It's not a for-profit, so people don't tend to look upon favorably bonuses quite the way they do in the private sector. But, like I said, it is key to have, qualified leaders at a very important level. So, I would support it as long as the bonus plan is written in a way that's defendable.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sonia?
John, there's criticism by some of the universities that they are receiving students who are not college ready. And as a Board of Trustees member, how would you address this?
From what I understood, when I was doing a lot of research for this interview, I read somewhere that those at the two-year institution have to have a high school diploma, so there isn't necessarily a requirement that you show other things, so you will end up getting some people who are not college ready. I think, first of all, I come from the perspective of accepting the fact that if you're going to have over 100,000 students, you're going to have some people who are not college ready. There's just no way to completely screen out all those folks. So I think the way to address it is to look at the selection criteria, to look at how candidates or students are entered into the system, how they're measured in terms of identifying students that might have more weaknesses in terms of their preparation than other students. And then I think once they are there, there might be some remedial or additional one-on-one tutoring or other things that may help get them up to speed. I mean, again, there's some balancing there because I wouldn't want to say to everyone, if you're not absolutely college ready, you can't come in, because some people may never get there. But yet I don't want to turn away that opportunity if we believe that once they get into the system, they can be successful. So I guess I don't have a perfect answer for that, but that's what I think.
Thank you.
Yep.
Yeah. Any other questions? Zeb?
How would you mainly... Because, in Minuscu, Minuscu looks into conflict of interest seriously. So how would you address conflict of interest if it arises?
Oh, conflict of interest, is that
yes.
What you're asking about?
Yes, mm-hmm. Question of conflict of interest and how you deal with
it. Well, that's not anything new to me. I have it at Wells Fargo and any major public company and smaller companies as well. And we have a policy on a conflict of interest and how to handle it and how to get approval and how to avoid it to begin with. And then I've served on the Minnesota Planning Commission, which they had a very clear policy and rules on conflict of interest. I think, you know, it's just basically being aware of it, being knowledgeable of it, understanding what the rules are, and whenever in doubt, you know, raise the issue to the legal staff or just the leadership staff and discuss it and see if it really is an issue. Because sometimes it's kind of gray when you actually look at the facts. If it isn't gray, then if there's not an issue, then you can vote on it. And if there is, I think you need to abstain or not be involved in that particular issue. So I think, you know, having strong ethics and not violating those conflict of interest rules is very important because, you know, there's a perception issue there, and you don't want to create a bad light on yourself or the whole board. So I think it is very key to follow the rules and to use good judgment.
This is just a detailed question. Tell me a little bit about what the Juvenile Division, the Diversion Council of the Boy Scouts is. I see you were there on it for 2 years.
Yep. So what that program is basically children who are most likely teenagers. They've sort of had some run-ins with the law, you know, underage drinking or maybe driving without a license or something like that. Actually, it's a program that the Boy Scouts started, and there's a diversion program where you basically do some other things. You go to group meetings, and you go to different activities, and it basically, it helps to get that criminal issue off of their record by doing other things to show that they're willing to grow and to, you know, obviously not commit the crimes again. So basically, it's an alternative in an alternative remediation program.
Okay. Great. Good. Anything else? We discovered this yesterday on our phone calls, that the phone calls go a little more quickly. Getting you back to me.
If I was there, I would feel like I was before the Supreme Court based on all that.
Have foregone wearing the black robes today, so.
I have a question.
Yes. Sonia?
John, there have been a couple places where you've alluded to the quality of education, the quality of our education in our Minsky system. What is your feelings that we're lacking in if we're not offering right now quality education that needs to be improved?
Well, I view quality as an evolving thing. I think it's something that's constantly got to be measured, constantly got to be checked, no matter what environment you're in. Just think of all your personal life experiences where quality might be good one day, and the next day you go to the same restaurant and it's not so good. So I think it has to be, it's an evolving thing, and it has to constantly be reviewed. When I think of the Minsky system, I think of a high-quality system. I'm a product of that system. So, I mean, what I loved about Morehead State University, I'm still stuck on the Morehead State University because that's what it was called back then, but it was a very, you know, high quality, very focused on academics, very focused on students, incredible faculty, preparing you for the real world out there and giving you great insight on your career. So, you know, I thought the quality, and I'm not just saying this, I actually believe it based on my experience, that the Minsky system has incredibly great quality. But I do think that because the students are our customers, and there are other stakeholders as well, that we constantly need to measure quality. And there can always be areas where you can find improvement. So I view it as kind of an evolving way. Not necessarily there's a glaring problem, but that you can always find improvement.
Thank you.
May I just say a word, please?
Yes, Yvonne.
Thank you, Yvonne Condell, professor at MSUM for 30 years. John, thank you for the endorsement of the faculty. We appreciate it very much.
But I had Roland Dill was the president when I was at Morehead State University. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he was president for about 30 years. He had a lot of long experience.
Right.
Yes.
Great. Good. Final question relates to the last question on the on your comment that you made. That is that the Minsky Board of Trustees, we tell people, demands about 40 hours per month. Not all of them daytime hours. There are daytime meetings and some visits to campuses around the state, and a lot of evening and weekend reading and preparation work to be a good trustee. Both are you and Wells Fargo in a position to ensure that that's a doable amount of commitment for the next 6 years?
Yes, and I don't take this responsibility lightly. I take it very seriously. It's a very important board, and it's a key position, so I am completely comfortable with the commitment that it requires, and I'm excited about the opportunity to be considered for it.
Great. Time for final comment or comments from you.
The one thing I would say, and I won't give a big long statement, I won't make it like a filibuster in the Senate, but the one thing I would say is that, you know, I come from my family and, you know, of my family that I was raised with, I'm the only one to graduate from high school. I did that. I then graduated from college and then went to law school, and actually neither one of my parents graduated from high school either. So I understand, you know, what it's like to come from a background. In my case, it was a large, poor, uneducated, you know, we did not have to be in education. I understand what it's like to come from that background, and I view public education, especially higher ed, I view it as an incredible equalizer. It takes in people from a variety of backgrounds, opens up their minds, creates insight into the world, and also creates opportunities into the world that they can reach for. So I view that public higher ed as a great equalizer, and I'm a great believer in it.
Well, thank you, John, very much, and enjoy the desert sun.
All right, thanks, guys.
Okay,
your time.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.